I'm Aaron Sagers, and this is Talking Strange.
Hey there, spooky nerds. Welcome to Talking Strange, the paranormal pop culture show. I'm your host, journalist, author, researcher of weird things, Aaron Sagers, also from 28 Days Haunted on Netflix and Paranormal Caught on Camera on Travel Channel and the Max streaming service, which is now filming its seventh season. Now, you know Patton Oswalt, comedian, screenwriter, actor, guy that's just become a pop culture icon. Last year, he and Jordan Bloom, who both together served as showrunners for the Marvel MODOK series on Hulu, they teamed with artist Scott Hepburn for Minor Threats. That is a comic published by Dark Horse Comics. Minor Threats is a graphic crime drama about superheroes and villains in the last gasp of the colorful innocent days, the Silver and Bronze Age, before they're dragged into a grit-soaked modern era. I really enjoyed this book. I picked it up last year. Picked up the trade paperback. It felt like this is a world of heroes and villains that has existed for a very long time. So I slipped right into it. And I'm excited to say Minor Threats is now back for a second volume subtitled The Fastest Way Down. And in the first issue, dropping April 3rd, Frankie Follis, a.k.a. the costume criminal Playtime, has won. Twilight City's greatest hero, the Insomniac, and its greatest villain, the Stickman, are both dead, which has allowed Frankie to unify the super crook underworld and assert herself as the queenpin of the Redport neighborhood. But Frankie is feeling the pressure from every side. Rival gangs are challenging her authority, her partner Scalpel is pushing her to legitimize her empire, and the act of murdering the Insomniac, spoiler alert, has broken something deep inside her. So she's about to learn the hard way that heavy is the head that wears the supervillain crown. But wait, there is more from this established world of Minor Threats, because spinning out of Minor Threats is The Alternates. Again, this was a trippy book. I really dug it. It's a tale of costumed underdogs featuring a support group for superheroes who are struggling to reclaim their mediocre lives in this world after tasting their true potential in another dimension called The Ledge. And these are the second tier, the bench warmer superheroes, but there are some great characters that come out of it, including Mary Monster, who is my favorite and takes on body parts and shapes from different monsters of fiction and lore. Anyhow, The Alternates is written by Oswalt, Bloom, Tim Seeley, with art by Tess Fowler, Christopher Mitten, and covers by Hepburn. And Dark Horse is buzzing with some more exciting news about Minor Threats, because that world is continuing to expand with the new spinoff series called Barfly, and the comic book, let's say it, Legend, Kyle Starks, is teaming with Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom on writing duties for this, what they're calling a coming-of-age series about an insect monster man searching for his identity in the criminal underworld. And I haven't even read it, but I'm excited about it because it just seems so funny and heartwarming. So there's a lot happening in this superhero realm, and the characters in the Minor Threats universe, they're kind of like Coen Brothers-esque characters. So, you find your favorites in there, and it's also, gets pretty violent, but also stays quite kooky and funny at times. Anyhow, Patton Oswalt and Scott Hepburn joined me to discuss the major league world of Minor Threats. And yeah, we snuck in a brief talk about Patton's role in the new Ghostbusters Frozen Empire movie. And I do try my best to get some info out of him about the future, even the paranormal future, of Minor Threats. So let's get to it. Patton Oswalt and Scott Hepburn join Talking Strange. Scott and Patton, thanks so much for being with me today. Man, first off, of course, the Minor Threats Fastest Way Down, Volume 2, that kicks off April 3rd. And then the Alternates trade paperback from the world of Minor Threats we get on April 17th. And down the road this summer, we have Barfly. I really love this world as a comic book nerd. I feel like I was dropped in the middle of this Minor Threats world, and I kind of got it right away. It was something that was both familiar, even though it was very fresh. I guess to begin with, looking back a little bit, was there this caution exercise to not make it a little too recognizable to sort of the DC and Marvel universes out there? I mean, yeah, Patton?
I mean, we had, you know, it was based on originally based on a Batman story idea that I had. So we really did kind of go out of our way to make these more universal tropes and give these characters their own personalities rather than do this weird Easter egg hunt, I guess. You know, I wanted it to, but you said how you felt like you've been dropped into the middle of this world, which I'm glad we achieved that. I wanted that idea of, I wanted to recreate what it is that Frankie's going through, which is she is sort of feeling the enormity of what she's stepping into. Everyone is feeling the enormity of things changing. So in order to give the reader that feeling, we wanted that little bit of disorientation at the beginning.
Yeah. And Scott, obviously through the trade paperbacks, it's cool. You get to see in the background sort of the evolution of these characters and their character designs. Even though some of these might be the analog to a Batman, they're obviously distinct enough. You know, you might think, oh, okay, Stickman kind of reminds me of a Joker character, but obviously looks very distinct. Talk about sort of designing those guys that would evoke these characters we might be familiar with from other stories, but also going off in your own way.
Yeah, it was a fun design challenge for sure. I try and think of all of our characters. I'm aware of the archetypes and Jordan and Patton. I kind of let them be the ones that measure how much into what ratio of that our story is guided by. And then I just treat it like a lot of these characters are kind of golden age, silver age-ish feeling. So I kind of just put myself in the like bullpen of a comic book artist in 1974 and be like, genuinely, what I got this script and it says this guy is the brain tease or Stickman or whatever. And what would it look like? I just draw it as if I am in that, like in the same place that these characters would have been when they were designing themselves. And I just sort of treat it as genuinely as possible. I kind of forget, like once you're like two steps into dealing with the characters, I kind of honestly just forget all of that backdrop, like all the baggage of any kind of like what we're basing it off, and just like treat them like brand new. It's a brand new world for me.
Yeah, no, and again, it feels like a brand new world. I mean, with you, Patton, when you and Jordan are writing this out, what did you feel like was a point with Frankie, specifically Playtime, but the other characters, where you felt like, okay, this was maybe the origin of where this story came from, but now I feel like she exists enough that I kind of trust her to go on her own journey, you know, kind of let the character lead the writing.
That, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, as we wrote it, we realized that Frankie kind of had some problems of her own obviously there's the problems that we made for her, which is, I got to survive the night. I got to figure out what my place is in this world. And then what we realized was, oh, well, now that she's stepped up to become the Queenpin, what if she's addicted to that old world? What if she's addicted to the risk of being at street level? And what if that is going to affect her ability to hang on to the crown, as it were, of the Queenpin of crime? And so that, you know, we, as far as the character getting away from us, I don't know that the character got away from us, but she certainly surprised us, as did some of the other characters too, you know, Brain Tease, Pigeon Pete, especially. And there are definitely some big surprises coming in volume two in terms of what a character presents themselves as and then where they end up going.
Yeah. Where do we pick up in Fastest Way Down volume, Mighty Threats volume two, like how long after the action wraps up in the end of the first arc?
It's about a year and more later. Frankie has established herself. Everyone has seemingly bought the big lie. But as we find out, as the series goes on, there's a young group of superheroes, kind of our Teen Titans analogs called the Action. And they, of course, absolutely reject this story and want to find out the truth. It's teenagers with powers, but not shying away from real teenage angst, the real teenage lapses of judgment, and trying to figure out who it is you are. We kind of embrace that. What does that look like when you have super speed or can manipulate energy? That can also go horribly wrong in a lot of ways.
So I've only read the first issue of The Fastest Way Down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this feels like a book about, you know, the bad guys, the minor threats. Do you have to be careful not to make it too much of a superhero book? You know, with the Action, if they take too much of center stage, are you worried right. about kind of, yeah.
Except that it with us, the moral line is kind of murky in this world, especially with how the Action are going about what it is they're doing. So depending on where you're looking at it from, Frankie is very much the protagonist and very much in a weird way, the hero, in that you could almost argue she has a slightly stronger moral line than some of these heroes,
mm-hmm.
which I really like.
With you mentioned Brain Tease, which I don't know, I really like Brain Tease, even though I see a bit of the Riddler in him, but I also think very much like Vincent Price Egghead from 1966 yes. Batman. And then I think about Vincent Price getting jacked in prison, which is...
Well, yeah, I mean, I loved the idea of, because this is also, it's a book about what happened when you know, the Silver Age 70s went to the grim and gritty 80s.
Right.
What effect must that have had on some of the cheesier people in there? Kyle Starks just did an amazing thing on a Peacemaker run for DC where he brings back, what is it, the Red Bee or the Crimson Bee? And like he's this older kind of zen sort of, it's just that I love seeing characters where their whole world gets shaken up, then how do they exist after that shakeup? What yeah. kind of person do they become in order to survive? I love that.
So Scott, I want you to start with this one because, like, you know, obviously there was the shift into, oh, okay, now these villains are maniacs and killers and everything that we saw, you know, post-Code. But even, like, during the time of Super Friends, for me as a little nerd, or reading some of the comic books that were more targeted to the younger audience. I remember there were characters where I'm just like, this guy, he's kind of lame. Give me, you know, Joker and Penguin and Riddler again. So what was the moment for you as a comic reader, as a fan, where you kind of keyed into the fact that not all villains are equal and some kind of suck at being villains and are definitely like the bench warmers of the baddies? Scott.
Sure. I think like we were kids of the 80s and I feel like there was like a real stretch there where heroes were just untouchable. There was no arc of character. It was like the Ultimate Warrior runs straight to the ring, defeats everybody, and then runs back out and there is no problem. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to out bench press his way through whatever problems in front of him. He'll never stub a toe. And then at some point, like, the villains start being everyone's favorite character. Like, I guess initially Wolverine, and then they realized how cool he was. We better make him a hero. Punisher, Deadpool, Venom, all these things where you love the badassness of them. But you weren't aware that you were craving some, like, human faults. You were looking for some, like, chink in the armor for these characters to be actually interesting and like to give the story some meaning. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's that, like when I started seeing those villain characters that are clearly meant to be booed when they come in, and then everyone is just like turning and like starts cheering for them unexpectedly. And I think that's where the light bulb goes off of like, oh, it's not about being like this nth level perfect hero. It's about being the most interesting character. Yeah. That's why you cheer for or like somebody or like a story in general.
And yet, even when we had like sort of the so-called complex Batman in the form of, you know, like Azrael, even after, it's like, Bane is a little more interesting to me anyhow. But Patton, what about you?
I'm sorry. That's a really great way to put it. You could see the wheels of commerce rolling in these people's heads where they're like, wait, they like these villains. And same with wrestling. You can see the moments when the hero wrestlers realize, wait, the heels are making more money. And they talk to their agent and went, okay, write a storyline where I go insane and become evil because I'm putting a new deck on the house. Like that, I love that's kind of going on. But the thing that I really loved about, and I remember giving this directive to Scott, this goes back to Brain Tease. I love the idea of somebody like Brain Tease who really, really loves the 1970s Silver Age. He likes wearing a colorful costume. It's a form of status for him. You notice in the bar, there's a lot of modern versions of supervillain costumes or more grittier ones. And he's still the guy in his primary costume with his headgear and wears it proudly. He's older and skinny, has a bit of a pot belly, but God damn it, that's the era he loves. And it reminds me of like a lot of the hair metal people like Lita Ford, who kind of beautifully stood against the whole grunge revolution of the early 90s. Like, no, I want my metal. I want my leather and my smoke machines. I want to put on a show. Like, there's something kind of beautiful about that he resists that for as long as he can.
Yeah, I guess it was probably the very first issue of Minor Threats. There's this, when we're seeing the lower levels bar, I thought about the cantina scene from Star Wars, and I thought, and my next question, and Scott, like, give this to me. Like, I was wondering, are each of these people we're seeing populating this bar, do they have already names and backstories, or are they more placeholders like Snaggletooth and Hammerhead, and later we'll just figure out what their deal is in this universe?
Well, I try as much as I can to like think, even in designing, most of those background people have some little like turnaround of them, just so I can keep track of the details that I've drawn. And often when I'm doing that, I'll write in the notes of like, you know, why did he lose a foot? His costume is like this because his power is expressed in this way. So it's made the ends of his sleeves tattered or whatever. And I try and lead design by actual story and character details rather than the other way around. Sometimes I'm just drawing something fun it spirals into something else. But
yeah, a lot of times you're drawing something fun sparks even more creativity, which is where we got Barfly from. He drew this little figure, human fly hybrid in a punk rock coat with punk rock buttons on, sitting at the bar, and Jordan and I totally fixated on him. I mean, there's so many other people he's drawn in the background but Kyle Stark saw that and said, I got a whole story for this. And I think it was that. And then also did Gridiron Ghoul come from you?
Yeah.
There's a guy named the Gridiron Ghoul. We didn't write the Gridiron Ghoul. He drew it in the background, and there's a whole, what is that story? What is he doing?
Imply as much as I can with whatever, you know, whatever visual I'm giving. I'm trying to like imply at least a rich history, and then maybe the specifics of that aren't, you know, I don't nail down entirely, but hopefully can roll into something. And then just by the amount of moving parts that we have, Patton will have like, I had an idea for some like teen storyline thing where that thing kind of fits in. It's like, just with enough time, you'll find places for a lot of these characters to fit in organically.
Fastest Way Down first issue, we kind of see like sort of the evolving politics and dynamics of Redport, this neighborhood in Twilight City. And first off, I gotta say, I freaking love the Holiday Gang. I don't think it's spoiling anything to say that. I really want to see more of these guys. And I guess,
you know what the Holiday Squad was? It's from an old notebook. And Scott and I have talked about this, and same with Jordan. growing up, I would draw horribly, by the way, and write out supervillain and superhero teams and what I thought they should look like. And I had a thing back in the 90s called the Holiday Squad. I never knew what I was going to do with it. And then suddenly it came up here. And then his designs for it were the one design I had a hand in was I just wanted Peter Rabbit, Peter Cottontail,
yeah,
be a guy going, look, I need a job in this team. If the thing is that I got to be the fucking Easter Bunny, I'll put ears on and that's it. Like the other people are really committed. He's like, he's the version of like the session drummer in Kiss. It's like, guys, I'm not going to wear the fucking cat, man. I'm not going to dress like a goddamn kitty cat. All right. I'll teach Peter Chris the chords. He can go out in the road with it. I'm not doing that shit. All right. And I love that idea. And he nailed it so perfectly too. He just looks, the poor guy looks so beaten down in his stupid bunny ears.
Mwah! It's just, I was thinking about with him that, and I guess we got this with, Snake Slayer, Cobra Guy, Snake Stalker. Again, it made me think of like, you know, the 1966 Batman of like these guys that are like, all right, I'll go work for the Riddler. I need a gig, you know, sure, you could put whatever name tag on me as Goon. You know, it's like the cartoon from the Flintstones, the pterodactyl that's like, it's a living.
That literally that idea. I mean, one of my favorite parts of I don't know if a lot of people didn't notice this. I noticed it immediately and I thought it was brilliant. In Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, when Tom Cruise goes to see the weapons dealer near the end, the guy that takes him to see him holds up a knit cap with the eyes and mouth zip, and it's the same guy that did it in the very first movie. And he kind of smiling like, you know, this is what I do. Like, I just work for whoever hires me. And Tom gives look like, oh yeah, you. Like they're all in this world together. Like, oh, it's a living. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, henchmen got a hench.
Who's going to work for me, man?
Do you, with this kind of new arc, I don't know if it's really spoiling anything from the end of the first arc, first volume, that, Playtime has a pretty big kill at the end there. You could say it if you'd like. Is this kind of her first kill, and is this going to be a theme about how it haunts her how it's changed her throughout this arc?
It yes, that is very much a thing that kind of will eat away at her, only because, and again, I think this is a very human thing. We all want to think of ourselves as justified and good. We want to be loved and understood. And that's one of those acts where she, you know, it's like, oh, am I the bad person here? Or am I weak? Was I acting out of fear? That's something that will really, really. And also, again, it gets back to the theme of the first one, which is I want to be a career criminal. I don't want to fucking murder people. I want to, real professional criminals are all about, it's not that they are squeamish. They're just like, I don't need murder on this. I'm coming here to rob this bank with everyone. Just calm the fuck down and let, you know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of, can we all just be professionals here? And so that she had to step over that line, and she is really shook.
Yeah. Well, it's like the code that you mentioned in the first arc. It's like, okay, even the citizens of Twilight City have to know, like, okay, Brain Tease is here. Just give him the money. Let the guy do his. We're insured. Like,
let him do his little speech. He's never killed anyone before. Fine.
It's not going to be a bloodbath. Like, just move it along.
Then Stickman shows up, and they're like, the fuck is going on? And they're like, that's why we had that issue four, when Pigeon Pete is like, he didn't even steal anything. He just murdered a bunch of people. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Scott, what are some of the characters that you're really loving drawing, doing artwork for in this arc? Especially because I think I'm noticing in the first issue kind of tweaks in some of the costumes that we've seen before. But yeah, speak to that a little bit.
I like to treat everyone like we're drawing a whole new world, and I kind of think of myself as like I'm the one artist who's drawing everybody in a way that, like, if it was the Marvel bullpen or whatever, these characters would have been like bounced around through like five or six artists by now, And there would have been little tweaks to like how big Spider-Man's eyes are and how many pouches they do and do they try them without a cape or whatever. And so I'm trying to like evolve the character designs in that same way that like the like years of just living in artists' hands, the characters get evolved. And I love, you know, it also gives me a chance to like update it. And like, usually those changes are for the better. Like Superman's symbol didn't stay the same because the new symbol is better. Like I'm trying to like give myself the window to like let the everything grow and evolve in a positive way for myself too. But the action is so fun to draw. Like, and I don't, you guys haven't seen yet. There was like a small window of some like some other characters, some friends of Toy Queens that are maybe the best characters of the whole series. They don't get enough page time yet. Hopefully we'll find a new home for them down the road.
But, or maybe Jordan and I do another spinoff thing.
Someone else does. I've got the character designs ready.
I mean, as far as the spinoffs go, Patton, like, was that your and Jordan's initial idea of like, okay, if this goes well, we got this other next level that we're going to go, we have this universe being built out, or was it just like, oh shit, that actually played, come up with something else?
Our plan was volume one, hopefully volume two, hopefully volume three. We did not expect some of our favorite writers and artists, people like Tim Seeley and Kyle Starks, to come to us and go, hey, this thing in the background, that could be a whole story. And we're just like, what? Like, and that kind of thing, when your world grows out of your own hands, is I cannot stress to you how thrilling that is and how amazing that is.
With this alternates, and the, as I said, the trade paperback for that is April 17th. That's where it's going to be available. And really enjoyed this one too. Again, like I felt like I knew what was going on in the world, even though I didn't know this story. And that's a cool kind of feeling to slip into. It's also, I think, you know, at least there's some pages in this trade paperback. This book fucks. Like the alternates. Like, I'm sure, like, it's like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, the artwork on it, the scenes in the ledge where you see the characters expanded, those, we gave those to, oh my God,
Tess Fowler.
And yeah. My God, did she just run amok.
Yeah.
Amok with that. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, the original, and why am I, I'm having the most senior moment. I'm blanking on the artist's name of the
Chris Mitten.
His artwork is fantastic. And oh my God, did he nail the way that the artwork in Vertigo books feels.
You know,
it's so precise and almost less, it's less filled with details and it's more about the characters and the subtle looks of things. But then
it's a grown up drawing in what used to be underground comics aesthetic.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly it. He totally nailed it. But then Tess nailed what did it feel like for these characters, where you could almost like feel the colors and smell sound. It's just everything is too much. And how do you recover from that?
It was, go on.
No, I'm just saying that the pairing of it was perfect. And like the sort of like, suddenly now you're in a fairy tale of like, heightened everything was so fun. I hope we get to do some more. I would love to see the follow-up to that.
It was like in those scenes, it made me think of, yes, Vertigo, and also like something out of a Neil Gaiman book. And
yes,
and I'm very like much. And even within that I was like, oh, and this is a way that this world could continue to expand in a whole other way aesthetically, and the stories that can be told over here. There's also this character, just side note, what cracks me up about the title of the book, The Alternates, is I feel a little bit spoken to, called out, attacked, I don't know, because I was also a couple of my friends when I was younger, we were the not quite cool kids. When the other kids would go out, we labeled ourselves the afterthoughts. So I feel like the alternates, I could relate to the alternates here. I feel like, but I also feel like I could hang with Crab Louie.
Sure.
Oh.
It's one of these characters, Tripper, I forget his name.
Tripper, Mary Marie, the multi monster, Louie, you know, there's Kid Curious.
Yeah, Kid
Curious. Very 90s. Very, very like cool alternative lo-fi 90s.
Well, Tripper is like Matthew McConaughey meets this G.I. Joe figure, which I happen to love as a kid, named Chuckles. Like this guy that just had a Hawaiian shirt on and he was just rocking it. Like, I think it was the Don Johnson influence in the 80s on G.I. Amazing. Joe.
But was he on G.I. Joe's team?
He was. Hanging. Yeah. And like, I think, you know, he was like the undercover spy agent. And then he had a brief moment in the animated movie. But he didn't get a lot of play other than that. But
all right.
I don't know. That's what the Trip guy reminds me of a little bit. But part of the idea behind this, did I read that it originated with Jordan's mom being a past life hypnotherapist?
I don't know. What? Yeah,
I could be entirely making this up, but I thought I saw that in some of the press.
Maybe that's something that Tim and Jordan were talking about and that sparked something with Tim. I'm not familiar with the past life hypnotist.
I could be, I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing I could entirely make up, but I don't think I did.
I want it to be true. It sounds awesome.
It does sound awesome. When you guys are working on these characters, well, I guess first off, Pat, I don't even know where you're finding time to slot in writing along with acting and doing stand up still and everything. Like, what is that process?
There's four Patton Oswalts.
Four, you've been cloned.
Sometimes I don't. There's days when I'm just like, there's a lot of days instead of having, I would love to say that I have a nice, steady writing schedule, but there's some days where I can't write for a few days because I'm on airplanes, I'm in hotel rooms, I'm doing interviews, I'm acting. And then there's one of those days off where I just like have this writing orgy where I just go for hours and hours and try to catch up. So this is a process of trying to figure out how to really schedule and map everything out. But, you know, but luckily this is something that it's not like I'm going, oh God, I got to go write. Or you know, like, this is something that I want to go do to relax. So, you know, it's not like writing is torture, if that makes sense. Writing is really fun for me.
Yeah, you get to go play with the action figures in your head.
That's exactly.
Where's the balance between what you're writing, what you're putting to paper, and Jordan? Like, how do you guys kind of attack it?
I don't think we've really found it yet. We were kind of going back and forth. I mean, a lot with, he's amazing with plot and mapping out the scenes to kind of deal with all of my big sloppy ideas of like, but she feels this way, so maybe make it do this, and you know, and then he knows how to scoot that along where it's not just me sitting there wool gathering.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
What about you, Scott? I mean, obviously, you know, you've worked on done art for like so many books, so much work, but when you're attacking this kind of thing, how do you get into the mindset of this world? Is it through music, or you know, how do you put on that hat for minor threats?
Yeah, I don't know. I always try and treat, like, even my Marvel gigs, I would try and treat it like something I've got a little more say in than I actually do. But there's been some, like, this is kind of the version of the job that I've always wanted it to be, where I'm contributing and I'm like building out visually pieces that can be used in the story rather than just facilitating a script. I'm like actively a part of the inner circle of what the world will be. I think I've just been waiting for this job. Like, this is by far I feel like I've got like a place to put good ideas, or at least fun ideas. Whereas before, you're almost you're almost causing problems. Like if you start pitching, what if this character did this, or I had this idea for like a take on this visual thing, and could we work with, like, you're just causing problems now for the writers and editors who already have a timeline and they've got like a script outlined already. So like, you're really not, that's not the role for you when you're doing work for hire stuff with the main two superhero publishers. But here there's like, they came to me before there was a script and were like, here's what we're thinking, here's how the story's going to play out. And then it started sparking things. What if we had a neighborhood like this? What if there was like details in the background like this? I'm trying to seed as much like visual things to work with for myself going in. And then that just starts snowballing. They're much more experienced writers, so they see the value in things and like, oh, that's cool. If we tweak it like this and we could plug that in over here, and that becomes a thing. And I start seeing how they're using stuff and like learning how to feed that machine better. It's a very satisfying situation. I love this gig.
I don't want to sound lazy, but we did learn very early on we could describe an atmosphere or a place or an interior and know that Scott will fill it with details that will spark even more stories and ideas. So, you know, it's great knowing that we have that resource, that Scott's brain is going to look at our writing and go, oh, I know how to populate this.
Yeah. Well, and pardon me for forgetting the name of the neighborhood or the section of Redport. That's sort of the time, the wibbly wobbly time section, but the artwork on that is just freaking gorgeous, where I was looking at that just kind of lost in it and picking up details. And then when I reread it again, finding new details, it's so much to kind of, it's a nice tasty treat to chew on. And I kind of, with that in mind, I mean, you sort of spoke to this, Scott, but I mean, I guess Patton add to this that obviously you've worked in sort of the established, you know, superhero worlds that we know. Is it not that you have to pick one or the other, but is it just ultimately a little bit more satisfying for you to play with the toys that you made in your own sandbox of your creation?
1,000%. I've been watching that the three body problem on Netflix. I don't know if you guys have been seeing that. That's why I have the three body solution analogy on my brain. But it's like the chaos of the three body problem. There's a writer and an artist can put out a predictable thing. Once you start adding this third element of like other ideas and like pitching visuals, and it just puts like so much chaos into the mix that the creative outcome becomes unknowable. Like, and that spiraling into other artists thinking of something, it's like there's no algorithm that could predict the outcome of that. And it's just like, the thing that makes it so much more satisfying is like, I couldn't have guessed how this would look, you know, when I started it. Whereas, you know, I draw a Deadpool issue, I kind of know more or less how it's going to go and what it'll, you know, it's fun, but there's a lot more richness and like creative fulfillment in work like this.
Yeah. I mean, Patton, for you, I mean, I guess I'm curious, like, obviously I want to know, I don't know if you can answer, like, kind of what you're all building to with this kind of quickly expanding universe. But, you know, on one hand, you think about convergence of characters, you know, someone that we saw in this book showing up and not necessarily team up, but convergence, or people taking on mantles of heroes that have died or villains who have died, or flashbacks to what this universe was like, you know, in the past. Are those all things that you're now kind of grappling with as we're into volume two, Minor Threats, we're getting Barfly, we're getting, you know, we've got alternates?
I don't want to say where it is we're going. We do have plans, but right now I don't really want to say, because they're still, well, some of them are formed. I just don't want to spoil anything. And other ones are still forming, and I know that that's very frustrating, but I have to leave it at that.
No, okay. I guess perhaps for you personally, are you more fascinated in stories that go bigger, Whereas stories that kind of go smaller with characters, more kind of intimate and insular.
I always like smaller stakes, but if you're going to make the thing bigger, if you're going to make the plot and the stakes bigger, if you do that, if you wait to do that until after you know all the characters and know who they are, you can then keep the big scale intimate. So that's what we're hoping to do down the road, and that's all I'm going to say right now.
Sure.
Sorry, that's all.
No. God, of course. I mean, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you, but you wouldn't be doing your job if you didn't stonewall me a little bit.
Okay, good.
But no, I get that. Are you, is there any kind of skill set from being a comedian and writing comedy that you have found ends up being a helpful muscle for working in comic books?
Not really. There's such different forms of communication and structure. I find that my time writing screenplays and for TV, that really helps with comic books, because if you can visualize your artist as your cinematographer, that's a great way to kind of get your ideas across in the script. So for me, I haven't really seen a lot of crossover.
Yeah. If may I ask you a Ghostbusters question?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, just because I had recently, I spoke to Gil Keenan, and I'm a big paranormal guy. I do a lot of paranormal stuff for my job. And I like your character in Ghostbusters. I like this kind of guy in chair, the library below the library where the real stuff is learned and everything. And Gil was telling me that on set, he brought in a lot of his own, you know, Mysteries of the Unknown books and his own haunted dolls. And obviously, yeah. Dan Aykroyd is a spiritualist.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and all of that great nerdy stuff. Do you have your own kind of fascination with that world? And is there something you can speak to about your connection to spooky stuff?
I have a fascination with that world. I've just never encountered it. I've never had a paranormal experience, and I'm surrounded by people, friends and family, who've encountered the paranormal, you know, but I've never seen a cryptid, UFO, ghost, time slip, nothing like that. It's just, I'm either vibrating on a frequency where that world doesn't touch mine, or it just, you know, they're waiting for one big thing to happen to me. I don't know. It just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with a world that I've never encountered, if that makes sense.
Did you have any like urban legends or creepy house at the end of the block from when you were a kid?
We just had and this was the 70s and 80s. So, and we're living in the Virginia suburbs. So it was all the generic stuff, like three or four generations down. We didn't have any of our unique stuff. And I know that there were certain neighborhoods that have had unique urban legends, but Sterling, Virginia definitely didn't have one.
Yeah. How about you, Scott? You grew up with any like legends or fascination with spooky stuff?
Man, I wish. I've been looking for ghosts and aliens in the night sky for as long as like I would love it.
Yeah.
I would love to see, you know what I mean?
So cool.
Yeah, it would be amazing. I don't know if I'm a skeptic exactly, but I think if I think about it on a realistic level, life is so weird that it can't be like, what's the difference? How much weirder is it really that there's a vampire than that anything is at all?
I agree.
I think it's just a way to express how that, you know, your human subconscious is like, really like, what the fuck is any of this? There might as well be aliens.
I'm kind of, I maintains skepticism. You know, I think there's weird stuff out there, but also a lot of bad wiring and leaky plumbing in the world. But I've always thought that being a kid that was so steeped in sci-fi novels and fantasy and comic books and horror and all of that has kind of laid the groundwork that if there was a giant alien ship or whatever that emerges over New York City, hopefully my brain would be prepped enough to be like, well, I kind of expected that one to happen. Yeah, but maybe the groundwork is laid a little bit.
There's an interesting theory I've always heard that things we see in the sky are just reprocessed by our brains into things that we can handle conceptually. That there's actually something way much bigger and cosmic and meaningful going on when you see a UFO. Just from the fact that in the 1800s, there were all these reports of like massive flying ships, dirigibles, and like, in other words, you just see an advanced version of the technology that you can already handle.
But yeah,
they didn't see massive flying ships. We're not seeing UFOs. It's actually something else that our brain isn't ready to process yet.
It's real weird when you start looking into stories of people that have like Santa Claus sightings, even as like some adults, because you're like, it's almost like that's just what their brain is beaming
exactly
back.
Well, that's what we can handle right now.
Is there, I know within the alternates, we see more of the magic side of the Minor Threats world. And we see in Minor Threats Volume 2, Playtime has kind of outlawed magic in Redport. But is there sort of a world, a Justice League Dark, a group of sorcerers in this world that, you may not be able to talk about it, but is this something that's coming up perhaps in the upcoming pages of Minor Threats?
I cannot say, and I'm sorry.
Okay.
So sorry. I'm not trying to be coy and clever. I truly cannot say.
No, I understand. So what, as far as with this volume of Minor Threats, though, are we looking at sort of a return of a lot of characters that we've already kind of dipped into, or do we have some kind of new threats that we hadn't seen yet? Tease out. I'm not saying reveal. Tease.
There are threats external and internal and cosmic coming.
That. Wow, okay. That was actually more than I expected. Also, I didn't expect cosmic.
Well, you'll see. You'll see what cosmic means in this world.
This, I think what you guys have shown with this Minor Threats world is that, for me anyhow, like, first off, I think the whole phrase of superhero fatigue is tired and cliche. It's sort of like elevated horror. It becomes this thing that people throw out in interviews. So right. I dislike it. And I really think it ultimately comes down to good stories and people telling them in the right way. But the response from fans, the response from readers, friends, colleagues that are kind of getting into this, has it kind of reinforced your faith in the superhero and supervillain genre, that people do have a continued appetite for these stories?
Well, it reinforces my faith of, and this has always been my line, is that imagination is infinite. And that whole idea of like, well, every story's been told before, that is such a cop-out for like, well, no, dig deeper, use your imagination. There's constantly new stories, you know, every single year. You go look at a movie like Poor Things or Everything Everywhere All at Once or a show like Squid Game. There are constantly new ideas, and there always will be. And the people who say that are the unimaginative who resent the imaginative.
Yeah. What do you think, Scott? Like, just the reaction to Minor Threats and having worked in the superhero biz for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing, whatever, you know, the feedback and the like the response and like what I see. I do a lot more comic conventions than the other guys. So I have like more of like a boots on the ground sort of feel of the impact of stuff. And I was worried that maybe there might be some lag between like my work on the Marvel books and like fans coming to me to sign to the Minor Threat stuff, but there was no slowdown. Like as the very first stuff that started coming out, that was now the most popular thing to get signed on my table. So I you know, I'm very optimistic for the future. And I feel like with the spin-offs and like the, I feel like Barfly in particular just feels like we've been pushing a momentum, and I feel like it's going to break an orbit. Like I have an instinct that says something special is going to happen with this Barfly book.
Is it set before the action of the first Minor Threat story? Just based on some of the artwork that I've seen, it seemed to suggest that, but can you say? If you can't say, that's okay. I mean, that's in July.
I think it is just before the first volume. Yeah. Frankie's working in the bar, so it can't, yeah, it's so like, it's sort of mid.
Yeah.
Right. Are we looking at sort of, How would this story kind of compare to what we've seen before, as far as, is this just like, you know, balls to the wall, crazy, bizarro story that that we're really kind of changing the tone, or does it still fit neatly within the...
Well, it is weirdly touching. It is a criminal coming of age story of, you know, someone in a weird way. It parallels Frankie's in that it is a henchman that has to figure out, well, what is my space in this world? Why am I in this world?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's excellent. It's so good. Cannot talk it up any higher.
Is there like a point where a minor threat becomes a major threat? I mean, like, is it still interesting to you if that, and I kind of touched, I'm circling back to another question, I guess, but is it still interesting if that minor threat becomes too major? Or, yeah.
I'm not going to say. Gonna oh, okay. Leave that in the air. Can't say.
Okay. I wasn't trying to get you with that one.
No. I just can't really answer that one.
I mean, you know what, for my money, as someone that's actually enjoying the series, it's better in a way that you can answer it, because it means there's more to come. Are we, I guess, just because I am also a nerdy collector, will we be seeing the merch come? Are we going to be seeing the action figures come? Is it, I mean, because it seems like the nice step.
Not going to say yet.
We've had so many... We got like some really fun email chains going right now.
Yeah.
We can't be specific about. But all I can say is like the amount of like what I really, for whatever reason in my mind, think about is like seeing the shelf at the comic book store, or the bookstore in a couple of years from now with all the spines of minor threats stacked up. And right now there's only two. Like we have the first volume of the main book and then alternates. And it's within another year, it's just like there's, it's exponential how much like we've got planned and the amount of fun stuff coming.
Well, what is your personal kind of your line, your catchphrase? What's the thing that you're loving that's come out of these books thus far? The quippy statement that, I don't know, may or may not have, would make a great t-shirt, or the thing that just sticks with you from the writing, Patton?
Oh my God, I'm so bad at this. I don't have the quippy thing. I don't have that. I can't boil it down into like a little quippy thing. I just can't. That's not my thing. Can't do it.
Right. Yeah,
we haven't been writing. They haven't been writing like in like one liners. So we don't have. I wouldn't mind at some point a Bite Burger T-shirt, like a T-shirt of the fake burger
stuff
franchise.
From within the world would be cool.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, I would love that. I always like it. That's kind of like where fandom has emerged. That we now get to indulge in the stuff that exists within that universe. And that's fun because it's part of that inside joke. It is pop culture. It's us communicating with one another. And just finally, I guess before I let it go, I mean, I'm let you guys go. I'm curious just the reaction you're getting from just the outside world. What's been some of your favorite kind of reactions, the interesting connections people are making with these books and with this universe? Anything that you're seeing that stuck with you?
I mean, I love the fan art. Different artists have sent us fan art of the characters, and that's always amazing. So that to me, that if what we do creatively inspires someone else creatively, that's the ultimate for me. That always makes me happy.
It won't be long, and mark my words, there will be a shit eater cosplay. I bet within a calendar year. I think that's coming.
Have you seen cosplay? Like, I know you guys were at San Diego last year.
Haven't seen Minor Threats cosplay yet.
No, not yet.
I think it's like yet. It takes like, I think it's now like out there enough that it's a good bet at probably San Diego, definitely New York Comic Con.
Oh, I hope so.
And that was Patton Oswalt making his debut on Talking Strange with artist Scott Hepburn. I appreciate their time for talking all things Minor Threats and a little smidge of Ghostbusters in there as well. Minor Threats is published by Dark Horse Comics, and Minor Threats Volume 2, you can pick up Volume 1, available now in trade paperback. Minor Threats Volume 2, The Fastest Way Down, kicks off with its first issue on April 3rd, 2024. And the alternate trade paperback drops on April 17th. And a little further down the road is the Barfly series, which is hitting on July 10th. So right around the time of San Diego Comic-Con. So we might be back with Patton and those guys at that point to talk about that. But in the meantime, look, check all of this out. Visit a comic book shop. Buy a comic. It's really important to support your local comic book shop. Or if you need to, buy it online. In the meantime, this has been Talking Strange. I have been and continue to be, for the foreseeable future, Aaron Sagers. And until next time, be kind, stay spooky, and keep it weird.
Talking Strange is a part of the Den of Geek Network, available wherever you listen to other podcasts. If you like what we're doing, share Talking Strange with your friends and fellow spooky nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and leave a nice review. If you have a strange or paranormal story you would like to share with us, please email talkingstrange@denofgeek.com for a chance to have it read on a future episode. For video episodes of Talking Strange, check out twitch.tv/denofgeektv and youtube.com/denofgeekus. And please follow @talkstrangepod on Twitter and @AaronSagers on Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon for more paranormal pop culture content.